Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Is the state budget based on a rosy scenario? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Governor Brown's budget for next year was balanced on assumptions that are not coming true. Revenues for last month were so far below expectations that the state is already halfway to triggering massive new cuts in spending. We'll hear from the governor's office and from Comptroller John Chung. Also tonight, Comptroller Chung issues a scathing audit accusing the L.A. Community College District of misspending $140 million. Later on, economics and high anxiety. First, here's the news. We're not only back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. The Great Recession wreaked havoc with the economy, and the slow recovery is producing headlines about a possible double dip. Americans have a right to be worried, and they are. How potent is psychology as a force for making things better or worse? We'll hear about that later on. First, a possible shortfall that could lead to cuts in state spending. Governor Brown and the legislature balanced next year's budget based on projections of how much revenue will be coming in. If those projections are off by $1 billion, massive cuts will be automatically triggered in higher education, health care, and other services. State Comptroller John Chung says the revenues for July were off by $539 million, more than halfway to the trigger point. Comptroller John Chung, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Warren.
Tell us what happened.
In terms of major tax categories, we were slightly ahead for personal income taxes, and we were behind in sales tax and corporate taxes. So we started off short. Obviously, we have a ways to go. We have to keep careful eye as to what the economy and what the revenue picture is for California.
How much were the income tax revenues higher than expected?
We were slightly ahead. Now, I want to put this in context. If you do year-over-year tax collections, we were ahead of last year. But we were hoping for a robust economy, for a lot of things to go right so that we would not have to put into effect the triggers. We're a long way from making that determination as the triggers. When I say we, it's actually the Department of Finance.
So income tax revenue was up 2.9%. That's a lot less than you'd hoped. Sales tax revenue was down 12.5% and corporate tax revenue down 18.3%.
Yeah, we have to understand that there's major transformations taking place in the world economy, especially as to where corporate taxes are going to be paid and where the revenues are being generated. It is clearly a global economy, so we're going to have to start to decipher whether a lot of that corporate revenue generation is taking place within the borders of the state of California or outside of California.
There's a favorite phrase in Sacramento, which is rosy scenario, and that refers to a situation where projections are artificially out of line, let's put it that way, too high or higher than they should be. Do you think this was a case of rosy scenario?
Well, they were hoping for the best, but we're also prepared for the worst.
John Chung is once more as the controller for the state of California. Come back to him in a moment. H.D. Palmer is deputy finance director for Governor Jerry Brown, formerly the same held the same office for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. H.D. Palmer, as always, welcome to our program.
Good to be with you, Warren, as always.
How worried are you?
Well, we're keeping an eye on things, but I don't think it's anywhere near close to being time to hit the panic button. A couple of observations. One, if you look at the way that revenues come in over the course of a fiscal year, July tends to be one of the lower revenue-generating months, just because it's a different month for receipts than obviously April is. The second thing, there's a little bit of difference in the timing for what the controller reports in his monthly reports and what we report in our monthly revenue bulletins, and it has to do with the timing of when revenues are recorded. Case in point, the controller's report suggests that the sales tax revenue for the month of July was down by about $140 million. The reports that we receive, which come in a little bit before the controller's deadline, suggest that we've already got that money in the bank. I want to hasten to add that that's not in any way, shape, or form meant to say the controller's reports are wrong and ours are right. far from it. It's just a it's an issue of timing. So the report that we'll be putting out in the next coming days on the sales tax front will be a little bit brighter than the numbers that we saw in the controller's cash report.
So the controller had $538 million but the controller had $538 million too little, and yours would decrease that amount by $140. That's still a big loss.
I don't want to minimize the fact that there are some other issues going on there. There are also other timing issues that can affect what revenues look like in a given month. But obviously people are wanting to extrapolate off of 1 month's worth of revenue what eventually is going to happen in December when the director of finance has to make a certification. And there is a whole host of data that have to come through the door in the coming months before anyone can say with any definitiveness, if you will, whether the trigger is going to be pulled in whole or in part or at all. And probably the biggest determining factor on that is going to be in the late fall when both we at the Department of Finance as well as the legislative analyst update our economic forecast and our revenue forecast. That is going to be a critical component of what both our updated revenue projections look like for the year and the ledge analyst. And we have to consider both of those when the Director of Finance has to issue that certification on or before December the 15th.
H.D. Vollmer, once again, with the governor's office. Back to the controller, John Chung. What do you anticipate between now and December? Do you think that you can be as optimistic about it as we've heard H.D. Palmer is?
I think the recent incidents portend a greater uncertainty. Obviously, consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds to 70% of the national GDP. The question is, you have to look at income versus expenditure patterns, and will they feel comfortable spending in view of the fact that we had the France issue impacting the stock market, we had the Italy issue impacting the stock market last week, we still have the issue as to what Washington, D.C. does with the debt ceiling issue. So the question is, do people feel confident enough to go out and spend?
So, H.D. Palmer, a somewhat less optimistic view of things from the controller's office. It's your boss, the director of finance, that would trigger the cuts if that were necessary, and you're saying that there's a lot of steps that would be necessary before that would happen. Tell us, though, if in fact you're $1 billion short, what would be cut?
Well, there are tiered reductions that have already been approved by the legislature that would go into effect. The first level would be about $600 million, and those would be reductions, additional reductions to the University of California, the California State University, a number of health and human service programs. And if we were to go $2 billion below, then you would be looking at things such as reducing the number of days of the school year at the end of next year by up to seven and eliminating things like home-to-school transportation. I do want to go back for a second, Warren. I don't want to suggest for a moment that we're not keeping a close eye on the same type of economic indicators that the controller has. If you're watching the stock market these days, you need one of those horse collars to prevent whiplash. And clearly there are a number of other forces, as the controller correctly notes, what's going on with Spain, what's going on with Portugal. It seemed to be one of the major issues that's roiling the markets. And that's important for us, too, because that will play into what our projections are going to be for capital gains. And as you and I have talked about on the show before, and I know the controller's observed, they can have a big effect on our budget. The most recent data that we have from the Franchise Tax Board suggests that the top 1% of all of the income tax returns that were filed in 2009 generated about 37% of all of the personal income tax that was taken in that year. So fluctuations in that narrow band of taxpayers can have a significant impact on the budget. So there are a lot of fiscal and economic challenges out there, and we are watching them closely, as is, I know, the controller.
Okay, so there are a lot of unexpected consequences of various things that can take place and a lot that the state doesn't control.
Well, there's that noted economist, Donald Rumsfeld, who once famously said, there are known knowns and there are known unknowns. And we've got, on the fiscal front and the economic front, we've got a lot of known unknowns that are going to be out there in between now and December the 15th.
H.D. Palmer, Deputy Finance Director for Governor Brown, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Let me go back to our controller for the state of California, John Chung. Still with us. You have issued today a blistering critique of the L.A. Community College District, which you point out is the biggest thing of its kind in the nation, with 250,000 students on campuses in 36 cities. You accuse the district of shoddy fiscal management of such magnitude that it will, quote, undermine the public's trust and threaten billions of public dollars. What's the worst of it?
What was incredibly disturbing is not only the aggregate amount, but the poor fiscal practices they had in place. So, for instance, if you're going to design a world-class educational facility, you ought to have a centralized review, district-wide process by which you understand the facilities that need to be built, what type of facilities need to be built for the education that you're providing, and that was absent here.
There were three separate voter initiatives involved, or voter measures, Proposition A, Proposition AA, and Measure J, authorizing funds for various things to repair, improve, expand, upgrade facilities, and so on. You say that they used some funds from one of those measures to take care of projects that were actually covered by other measures.
Yeah, they didn't have proper accounting in place, so they overspent, according to one bond, and to continue the building and construction of those facilities, they use proceeds from another bond. You have to have specific designation as to the use of those monies, and unfortunately, in many cases, they were not doing so.
In one case, they spent $86 million to develop a satellite campus called the Vandekamp site, found out they didn't have the funds to operate it.
They didn't have the monies for the operational use of those facilities, so those facilities today are being leased out for other purposes. It seems they just wanted to construct without a full understanding of full life of that project.
One of the reasons that these measures passed was the promise of citizen oversight committees. What do you think about them?
Well, citizen oversight committees are absolutely critical to establishing an independent eye and review of the process and to build trust with the public so that voters can support these projects in the future. Unfortunately, in this case, the Citizens Oversight Commission did not fulfill its responsibilities, did not come up with independent and critical reviews of the improvements that needed to take place.
Supposed to provide annual reports, and in case of the head Citizens Committee, failed to issue a report for 7 years.
That's correct.
John Chung, did you get to some of your information, or was your audit based on the series of reports about the district by the Los Angeles Times?
Well, the Los Angeles Times did extraordinary work for this particular audit. My auditors go in there with a fresh eye. They have standards that they have to uphold, and these were the findings they came up with.
Okay, John Chung again, controller for the state of California. Thanks very much for being on our program today.
Thank you, Warren. Be well.
Michael Finnegan is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He was the author of that series on the L.A. Community College District, which ran in February, as I remember, Michael Finnegan. Is that right?
February and March. It was myself and a colleague, Gil Holland.
Okay. What did you find that we haven't already heard from the controller?
He reiterated a lot of the things that we did find along the lines of tens of millions of dollars wasted on projects that were abandoned and sort of toothless oversight by the committees that are supposed to be set up to watch out for the money. But there were a few new things in there. The controller found that the college district had approved $30 million to be spent on public art, which the voters had not authorized. And the controller also found possible malfeasance in the naming of an inspector general to investigate allegations of fraud and corruption.
Malfeasance in choosing an inspector general is pretty serious malfeasance. What did they do wrong?
Well, we had reported that the inspector general who was hired had no background in audits, independent audits and investigations, and that she had worked, I think it was for about 5 years, for one of the major contractors on the program who was a major donor to the elected trustees who run the college district. But the controller raised questions about the selection process itself that were fairly serious, finding things like there were 11 bidders, including some major international accounting firms, for the position of inspector general. And the one that was chosen, Policy Masters, was the one that got the second lowest score of the 11 bidders. And none of the four highest scores were interviewed, much less given serious consideration for the position.
Suggesting perhaps a conflict of interest.
Well, suggesting that something was amiss in the way this occurred, and the controller called for an independent investigation of how this inspector general was chosen, and the district, the chancellor, Daniel LaVista, has already rejected that recommendation, and it turns out that this was one of the first major decisions that the Chancellor LaVista made when he joined the district about a year ago.
Okay. We invited the district to participate in the program today. They said they were all in meetings. I'm not sure who all refers to, but everybody was in a meeting, and they weren't able to join us. You talked about abandoned projects in your series, and I think that the controller said, perhaps you did as well, that there was an aggregate of something like $140 million wasted. Can you tell us more about that?
I don't know a lot about how the $140 million number was arrived at, but I can tell you that we certainly found tens of millions of dollars wasted in a whole variety of ways. I think the most striking was probably at West L.A. College, where everyone from the top of the program down to the college, the construction program, basically the leaders of the construction program, had approved a couple hundred million dollars worth of contracts, when, in fact, they didn't have enough bond money to build all of the buildings that they had signed contracts with contractors to build. And so they canceled four major buildings, and they were already on the hook for spending. Well, they had already spent a minimum of $27 million on the design and early construction work on these projects that it turned out they were never going to be able to build. So that money's gone. And there were, well, that's probably the worst instance there was.
So were those projects on the ballot? Did voters, when they approved the measures, think that those things were going to be built, or did they come along afterward?
Well, it's not quite that simple. I think the ballot, the project list doesn't appear on the ballot, but the legal setup for getting a bond measure approved is the Board of Trustees has to approve a very specific project list, and then the ballot measure asks more generally if these purposes are acceptable to the voters for borrowing and spending money on construction. And any voter who's curious is free to look up the project list that was approved. And the controller's finding today is suggesting that a number of instances, such as the $30 million in public art, the college district spent money on things that were not on those lists that got approved before the bond measures went to voters. I don't think, though, the $30 million in public art, I don't know how much of that was actually spent. I think they approved that, and only a portion of that probably would have been spent by now.
So the new chancellor, Mr. LaVista, doesn't want to investigate the selection of the inspector general. Has anything else happened in the meantime? Have there been any changes?
The district attorney has launched a criminal investigation of some activities at Mission College, where a college vice president was co-owner of a company that was getting work from some of the contractors that she was supervising on campus, that she was in charge of. Of course, she denies that she did anything wrong, and nothing yet has come of that investigation by the DA. The District Citizens Oversight Committee is meeting more often, the controller has basically suggested that the first report that it's issued, now that it has taken a more aggressive approach to the oversight role that it's supposed to be playing, the controller suggested that was basically a publicity document, its first report. So it's not clear that the oversight has gotten a lot stronger yet. We'll see what happens. There are a couple new elected trustees overseeing the district. It's a board of seven members, and two of them are new, and both of them have suggested that they are going to be more vigorous about making sure that this bond money is spent correctly, and they just got on the board, so time will tell.
Okay, we'll be hearing a lot more about this. In the meantime, Michael Finnegan, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. The Electoral College gives states the power to elect American presidents. Because some states have more voters than others, some presidents have taken office without a majority of the vote nationwide. George Bush in 2000 is the most recent example. Yesterday, Governor Brown made California the 9th state to try to reform that process by signing Assembly Bill 459, authored by San Mateo Democrat Jerry Hill. Assemblyman Hill, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. It's good. Nice to be here, Warren.
What does this do?
Well, what this bill does, very simply, is that the national popular vote guarantees that the presidential candidate who receives the most votes in all 50 states will be elected president.
Now, as I understand it, this would mean that if a Democrat, most likely, were elected by the voters of California, but a Republican got the majority of the votes nationwide, then all of California's electoral votes would go to the Republican?
That's absolutely correct. That it would go that way if the election were to happen in that outcome. The vote would go to the person who received the most votes in all 50 states. California's electoral votes would then go to that candidate, even if California, as a total, the votes went the other direction. And that's the best part is that each vote will count still, and that's the important part. Right now, our votes don't count in a presidential election. But if you allow each vote to count, then our votes are just as important as those votes in Florida, in Ohio, and some of the battleground states that currently are controlling the election. And as we've heard, Warren, that in the next presidential election, that'll be determined in 12 to 15 states, which means that two-thirds of us will not have a say, nor will the issues that are important to those states, like the issues that are important to California, will be irrelevant in that campaign and during that election.
I understand it's unlikely you could get enough states to go along with this to have it apply to the election of 2012. How close are you? How long do you think it might take?
Well, with California, we now have 132 electoral votes, which is 49% of the 270 that are needed to have a majority. And it looks as if a number of other states, I believe Michigan and some others, are looking at it in the next couple of months and may pass it. But I think it's probably at this point highly unlikely that we'll have the 270 by next year. And if that is the case, then certainly in the next presidential election, we should be able to have the right number, especially if some larger states come on board.
California has turned out to be pretty much a blue state. Consequently, candidates haven't campaigned here very much. Do you think this will change that?
Well, I think it will have to change that because, as you're absolutely correct, in the last presidential election, Obama and McCain campaigned. Well, they raised campaign funds in California to the tune of about $160 million, yet they spent in California about $30,000, which is a lot less than we spend as elected legislators in California. So the focus is not on the issues that are important to California, whether it's offshore oil drilling, agriculture, high-tech, biotech, biosciences. Some of those important things that are important here are never discussed. When you talk about immigration policies, and the immigration policy that's discussed is Cuban immigration, because Florida is one of those battleground states. So it's an area where we just don't have a voice, nor do about two-thirds of the other states in the United States having a say in this election.
Can the states do this by themselves, or does it require a constitutional amendment?
States can do it. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution gives the authority to allocate electoral votes strictly and clearly to the states. In fact, Massachusetts has changed their manner of allocating their electoral votes 11 times since the country was founded. In fact, the first presidential election, only three states actually allocated their votes and their electoral votes in the same manner that we do, which is the winner-take-all policy. So it's left up to the states to determine how they and what they feel is the best manner to do that.
This was not a bipartisan bill in Sacramento. Very few Republicans went for it. I think just two altogether. How come?
Well, it's interesting. When I first authored the bill and it became more public, we had quite a few Republican assembly members and senators who were signing on as co-authors for the bill. Then all of a sudden, the chair of the state Republican Party came out in opposition to the bill. When that happened, we saw kind of an exodus, or at least the desire of the Republicans to remove themselves from the bill, and it did get, I believe it was two votes at the end from Republicans. And that's kind of contrary to what we've seen around the country. This bill has received, throughout other states, tremendous bipartisan support, because people can see that when we talk about the 2000 election, which you mentioned earlier, with Bush and Gore, and the fact that Gore received the popular vote and Bush received the electoral votes, in 2004 with Kerry and Bush, had, you know, Bush had won by about 3 million votes, about 3 million votes in that election, had 60,000 voters in Ohio, just 60,000 voters, but voted differently in that election, Kerry would be president today, even though Bush would have received almost 3 million votes more than Kerry did. So it's related a lot to where states are and who has the electoral votes, which, you know, that's contrary to how we look at elections. We've always felt that the person who receives the most votes should be elected, no matter who we elect in this country. And I feel, and I think most people feel, that that should be the same for president.
Okay. Assembly Bill 459, now law in California. We'll see what other states do. In the meantime, Assemblyman Jerry Hill of San Mateo, Democrat, thanks very much for being on our program.
Thank you. My pleasure, Warren.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, economics and high anxiety on Which Way LA. We're only back with Which Way LA. Americans are anxious about the economy, and today we're going to address the consequences of that anxiety. First, let's talk about what there is to be anxious about. E.S. Browning is Wall Street reporter and columnist at the Wall Street Journal. E.S. Browning, Jim Browning, good to have you with us.
Well, good to be here.
I guess the first question would be having to do with anxiety, immediate anxiety. What's happened on the markets today?
Well, they fell very heavily in the first half of the day, and they've been slowly trying to climb back since then. The Dow just went over 11,000 as we speak at this particular moment. Obviously, there's lots of time left in the day, so no telling how it'll end up.
Yeah, you never know. At the end of the day, sometimes there'll be a complete reversal.
It's just impossible to know. It could surge back up. It could drop back down. The markets have been scarily volatile over the last few days in particular, and I don't think anybody wants to try to predict it short term.
So that's certainly something to be anxious about.
It has been very anxiety-provoking, especially for ordinary people. You turn on the television and you see what's happening, and you immediately think about your poor, benighted savings and what's happening to them.
How does this differ from, let us say, the 90s?
It differs heavily from the 1990s. During the 1990s, it was a period of very strong, sustained economic growth. The federal government, as you remember, actually went into a budget surplus at the end of the 90s because the economy was so strong that it was just bringing in lots and lots of revenues into the government coffers. It was a period of high optimism about the future of year after year of 20% stock market growth annually, a time when people thought the sky was the limit and that technology inventions and advances in particular were going to change the world in a hugely positive way for as far as the eye could see.
When that turned out not to be true and we had the Great Recession, how big a blow was that, do you think, to the psychology of what you've just referred to as ordinary Americans?
Well, I think there's been a real sea change. We've gone from a period where people really could not see downsides in the 1990s to one where fundamentally people are just waiting for the next shoe to fall. And you can see it especially in the behavior of ordinary Americans toward the stock market. In the 1990s, if you didn't have an electronic trading account, you were behind the times, and if you weren't trading exotic technology names, you were out of it. Well, now many, many Americans are just fed up with stocks and are not putting their money into them, and are deathly afraid of the next thing that's going to happen. It's been a huge, huge change in mentality for the average American, and on top of that, we have this sluggish economy that is not generating the kind of growth and the kind of tax revenues that we need. We have a fear of the future. It's just we have this enormous debt overhang now, where we're running up our debts without any, or rather, we're trying to run down our debts, but without any immediate ability to pay them all off. And so, it's really just been a like night and day between the 1990s and the 2000s, unfortunately.
What do you think is the impact of fear itself on the economy?
Well, economists increasingly think that the psychology of market players, not just individuals, but also decision makers in business, has an enormous impact on the economy. And there is a growing branch of economics called behavioral economics, which studies things like this. And they truly believe that the level of confidence is one of these self-reinforcing or self-destructive elements, depending on whether people are becoming more confident or less confident. And right now we have a period where one of the sharpest ways to see it is that corporations are sitting on huge amounts of cash hoards, and they're just not willing to invest them because of a lack of confidence, and that just plays directly into the economy and stifles growth.
9% unemployment.
Exactly. It creates unemployment. It creates a reduced demand for investment goods. It stifles the whole thing. And to a very large degree, it's a psychological confidence element. I mean, it sounds kind of goofy to think that psychology and confidence could have such a big impact on the economy, but it really does.
Jim Browning again with the Wall Street Journal. Eric Tyson is a financial consultant, syndicated columnist, author of Personal Finance for Dummies and Investing for Dummies. Eric Tyson, good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be with you, Warren.
Is it dumb to be fair, to be afraid?
No, it's perfectly human to be afraid. And, I think people should acknowledge their fears, because if you don't and you think that it's irrational or it means there's something wrong with you, you're probably not going to react properly.
Okay. Well, what is the appropriate way to react? Especially interested to talk to you in this regard, because as I understand it, you're an optimist.
Well, I do try to see the glasses half full, and you have to be that kind of a person if you're going to invest in stocks. And the good thing about the stock market is that we have a lot of history to look at. I mean, this is not the first time that the market has dropped 15 or 20% in a matter of weeks. I mean, it happened back in 1998. It happened back in 1987. I can't tell you. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know, is it going to drop further from here? My guess is it probably won't. But, we've been through periods like this before. And, the lesson hopefully that people should have learned from 2008 is that if you panic and sell when things look the bleakest, you're going to miss out on the good times. If you're going to be in the stock market, you've got to accept the fact that you're going to go through some turbulent periods, and the last several years have certainly fit the bill, and you have to take a long-term perspective.
Back to Jim Browning, what about that? You have to see the glass as half full if you're going to invest in the market. If people don't see the glass as half full but rather half empty, are they going to pull out of the market?
Well, history shows that indeed they do, but I have to agree that it's often an error. There have been many, many academic studies showing that individuals in particular, but also professionals, tend to make errors when they try to pick stocks or time the market. Especially if you're an ordinary person saving for retirement, I think that the question you need to ask yourself is not, is the market going to go up or is it going to go down? The question you need to ask yourself is, how much longer do I have before I retire? I mean, if you're 40 years old, you shouldn't be worrying about what the market is doing this week or this month or even this year. You should have a balanced portfolio geared toward the kinds of things that you think are going to grow in value over the period of time. If you're 40, you're talking about 25 years. That should be your horizon. And the problem that individuals have is that they get all caught up in the day-to-day fluctuations in some of these crisis moments, and they lose sight of the long run, which is the real reason that they're investing. Now, if you're a professional money manager, you have to take a short run view. That's what you're paid for. But if you're an ordinary person, it usually is a big mistake to take a short run view.
Eric Tyson, agree with that?
I do. I think that was very well stated. And I to that I would add that people should dig deeper behind some of the commentary that's out there. And take a recent example. Bill O'Reilly has a very popular show on Fox Television, and he said a number of weeks back that he just made the blanket statement after telling his viewers that he only has 20% of his own money in the stock market. He made the blanket statement that Americans are out of the stock market because they've lost confidence, and that's just simply not true. If you look at a number of large 401k plan providers like Fidelity and Vanguard, Americans have actually made relatively minor changes in terms of contributing to retirement plans despite the enormous turbulence in recent years. So the fact of the matter is that, I guess it concerns me because if you hear comments like that in the mass media, it can mislead people into thinking, well, geez, here this popular commentator is telling me he's only got 20% of his own money in the market, and he's also telling me that other Americans have thrown in the towel and have lost confidence. Then you begin to doubt your confidence in sticking with the market, and I think that's the wrong way to make decisions. And I agree with Jim that you got to come up with your own plan, and you got to stick to it.
Eric Tyson again, author of Personal Finance for Dummies and Investing for Dummies. Don Peck is features editor at The Atlantic Magazine. He wrote next month's cover story, Can the Middle Class Be Saved? That's adopted from his new book, Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don Peck, good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Can the middle class be saved?
Well, it can be. That's one of the main messages of my book. But the policies that we seem to be pursuing right now will make it very difficult, as Jim and Eric have both alluded to. We're in a tough period, and we're likely to remain in this period for a long time. There's little sign that we're going to recover quickly. And the government really does need to take broader and more aggressive action to support ordinary Americans today and help them recover.
In what specific ways could they do that? And if they did, they being the government, would it turn around or help to turn around this psychology of despondency that we've been talking about?
Well, it's interesting that this despondency, this psychological factor doesn't just affect markets. It affects how we view all of life, really. In previous recessions, in the early 80s and the Depression, people became very, very conscious of government debt. It's a very natural psychological, emotional reaction. You think, well, we can't afford this. We become very risk-averse in every way. And that is affecting our politics today. In a recession when unemployment is, or a jobs recession when unemployment is this high and economic growth is this weak, it's not the time to be focused exclusively on debt. We need to address the debt in the long term, but our actions right now in turning towards austerity, towards debt cutting this year, right now, is highly counterproductive. It's understandable given the psychology of the market and of ordinary people, but I fear it's likely to prolong this period.
Are you one who thinks that it's time for the government to do more stimulating of the economy?
I do. I think it's quite clear that that's needed right now. It needs to be paired with long-term cuts to reduce debt once the economy becomes healthy. But there are clear opportunities such as infrastructure investment to bring unemployed construction and manufacturing workers back into work quickly, aid to the states to keep teachers, firefighters, police employed. These are necessary actions to bolster a flagging economy.
Don Peck again with The Atlantic Magazine. Back to Eric Tyson. Speaking of debt, is this a good time to buy a house?
I really do think that it is in most parts of the country. We're having a sale. If you factor in the reduced prices coupled with low interest rates, people can buy real estate at affordability levels that we haven't seen in many areas in decades. I mean, it wasn't that many years ago that the concern in the real estate market was that people would look out there and say, gee, I don't really see any prospect of my kids growing up and someday being able to afford a home. The good news is that homes are affordable now, and despite the significant price drops in many markets, Real estate has been a good long-term investment if you look over the decades of most people's adult lives. So I think if you're a renter and you have the visibility of a reasonably stable occupation and income stream, I think it's a terrific time to look at buying.
Again, the glass is half full for Eric Tyson. Back to Don Peck. You have written that recessions leave permanent scars on society. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we think about recessions as temporary, and of course economies do mend, but particularly for deep and long recessions, they leave us with enduring consequences. They change the work we do, the places we live, you know, even who we are. So I think the most prominent example of that right now is for the millennial generation. You know, the first couple of years in the job market is extremely important to establishing one's career track, and people who struggle early not only start behind, they never catch up. So periods like this aren't just bad for a couple of years, they can leave long-lasting consequences that endure, you know, well beyond recovery itself.
And when you say it changes who we are, elaborate a bit on that.
Well, you know, during downturns, people drive less, they drive more slowly, pop songs become more earnest, more complex, less overtly sexual. You know, conservatism, personal conservatism kind of prevails in almost all things, and particularly for young people who are still forming their opinions about life. Being stuck in a period like this leads to pretty significant personal changes frequently, which then endure for a lifetime. I do think that from my reporting, from my conversations with people in their 20s around the country, you know, there's evidence of a new thrift. There's evidence of a turning back towards family, towards friendships. I would guess that some of these changes will endure long past recovery itself.
Don Peck again with the Atlantic Magazine. Eric Tyson, back to you with Personal Finance for Dummies and Investing for Dummies. Does that mean they're less willing to take risks?
Potentially. I mean, certainly to the extent that, people are less optimistic and less convinced that there are stable and good times ahead. Yeah, all things being equal, people are going to pull in their horns and they're probably going to be a little bit more cautious.
So, E.S. Browning, that confirms what you said, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, that people are more likely to get out of the market. You have to be willing to risk if you're going to get into it.
Yeah, what you're seeing is that people frequently don't change their 401k allocations, but what they do is they just don't like to put extra money into the stock market at a time like this. And often you actually have to go through sort of a washout where people get really, really negative and they really pull back heavily before you finally bottom out and move back ahead. It's unfortunate. I mean, we're in a period where people are very negative about the economy. They're negative about investing, and eventually you have to get through that negativity, and then you can begin another upswing.
Aaron Courier is project manager for Pew's Economic Mobility Project. And Aaron Courier, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What have you found about the way in which the recession has affected people's feelings about their economic opportunities?
Well, Pew's Economic Mobility Project investigates the factors that influence Americans' ability to move up and down the income ladder. So in addition to our research reports, we've conducted two public opinion polls, one in 2009 and one this year. And we found that on the one hand, Americans are really feeling the negative effects of the current economy, and they've grown increasingly pessimistic about their personal finances in particular. Only about a third rate their financial situation as excellent or good, which isn't an overwhelmingly surprising number in and of itself, but that is a 23-point drop since the start of the recession in 2007.
Wow.
And at the same time, Americans are getting more nervous about the economic security of their kids. In 2009, we found that 62% predicted that their kids would have a higher standard of living than they do now, but that number dropped this year all the way down to 47%. On the other hand, though, we do see a lot of underlying American optimism. 68% of people are sure that they're in control of their economic situation, and the same percent believe that they have achieved or will achieve the American dream.
That's 68% or 58%?
68%.
Wow.
And more than half also believe that they will be better off in 10 years than they are now. So we see that while Americans do feel the pinch of the economy, they still feel very much in control of their situations and like that there's a good future ahead.
Sounds somewhat contradictory. If people feel by large margins that their children are not going to have a better future than they have, and yet at the same time they feel so optimistic about the their ability to control their economic situation.
I think part of the reason for the optimism is that in both polls and in focus groups that we conducted ahead of our polls, we find that Americans are convinced that the things that matter the most for a person getting ahead are personal attributes like hard work, drive, personal ambition, and structural forces like the economy or a person's family background matter less. And so, you know, while Americans definitely understand that the economy is hurting them, that the unemployment rate is devastating, they still feel like if you work hard and you play by the rules, you're going to be okay.
You have divided the people that you talk to into various different categories, racial differences, class differences, and others as well. Tell us how these things, these numbers differ. For example, what about white working class men?
Well, I think we see that those who are working class, who have less than a college education, are a lot more pessimistic than those who have a college degree. And that is sort of across racial differences. And it's not surprising because we know from past research that a post-secondary education is one of the strongest drivers of economic mobility. Some of our research has shown that of kids who are born to parents in the bottom of the income distribution, they're four times more likely to reach the top themselves if they have a four-year college degree than if they don't. So I think it just speaks to the fact that Americans recognize the importance of education, and when they have that, they have additional economic security and then additional economic mobility.
What about other groups?
Well, I think it depends on the question you're asking. You know, one of the most interesting findings that we had in this most recent poll is that, contrary to maybe what the political situation would suggest, Americans strongly believe there is a role for government in promoting economic mobility. 83% actually want the government to provide opportunities for poor and middle-class people to improve their economic situations, but that's a feeling that cuts across party lines, regardless of political affiliation, race, and income.
Again, Aaron Currier is project manager for Pew's Economic Mobility Project. Let me go back to Don Peck with The Atlantic, author once again of Can the Middle Class Be Saved, the cover story in this month's Atlantic magazine, and taken from his new book, Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Does what we're hearing from Aaron Currier correspond with your own findings?
It does, and that ambivalence is absolutely present in America today, and it's not unusual. You know, American society particularly is very resilient, particularly when downturns are short. But what we see, if we look at history, is once weakness, once a sense that you're not progressing, not getting ahead, you know, once that progresses beyond 2, 3, 4 years and starts to feel like a more permanent situation, you know, that's when in the past we've seen society really begin to change, politics become meaner, people start to lose a sense of agency and feel more fatalistic. We saw that in the 70s, we saw it in the 30s, and so my concern is, you know, among the many other reasons to focus very hard on adding speed to the recovery and getting out of this period as quickly as possible is, you know, once periods like this one go on long enough, they do start to lead to more fundamental changes in the way people look at life and opportunity. And, you know, the sense of opportunity within the middle class and broadly within America is one of its greatest traits. And I just worry that we are slowly losing that and will do so, you know, much more if in 3 or 4 years we're still in a situation roughly comparable to this one.
Aaron Currier, when you say that people feel there really is an important role for government, did you pull beyond that? What role for government? What is it that people want the government to do?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, right now, 80% of Americans think the government is doing a really ineffective job of helping poor and middle-class Americans, and that the government is also helping the wrong people. In fact, more than half of Americans think the government currently does more to hurt people trying to move up the income ladder. So the kinds of things that they identified in our poll as being effective things the government could do actually align directly to the research that we've done on key drivers of economic mobility. For instance, they believe that the government should ensure that all children get a quality education. They want the government to promote job creation and ensure equal opportunity. And also they want basic needs provided to the very poor. One of the sort of key messages that we got in our focus groups was this feeling that Americans want the government to provide a hand up, not a hand out. They believe that it's people's individual responsibility to take advantage of opportunities and to work hard, but they still believe the government should play a part in making sure that those opportunities are available.
Aaron Currier with the Pew Economic Mobility Project. Back to E.S. Browning, Jim Browning, Wall Street reporter, columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Earlier, Don Peck said that he thought there should be more stimulus. We're now hearing that polls indicate that people perhaps feel the same way. What are the prospects for that?
Well, that's the problem. The prospects seem pretty bleak. Congress can't even agree on how to raise the debt ceiling, and you know, they've had to create this special committee, which now people are worrying whether they can even agree on anything. It's a big problem that, you know, I remember after the 2010 election, a lot of people on Wall Street thought it was really great to have divided government because they think it's good for the stock market because the government doesn't try to do very much, so they leave the markets alone. Well, I think it's turned out that divided government hadn't been so great for anybody.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Eric Tyson, again, author of Personal Finance for Dummies and Investing for Dummies. Don Peck at The Atlantic. A cover story this month, Can the Middle Class Be Saved? The book, Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Aaron Currier with Pew's Economic Mobility Project and E.S. Browning, Jim Browning at The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much, all of you, for being with us today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl with Katie Cooper and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. You can join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.